Accession number 18467, Reel 4.
With Reel 4.
With nobody daring to fire a weapon, getting safely along this road which the French had gone blasting their way through, causing unnecessary distress.
Was there, in fact, in Vietnamese resistance in the area?
No. When the Vietnamese, the local Vietnamese, heard the French were coming, they, I think they wanted us to stay, if possible. They certainly didn't want the French back. But all that was done at brigade level. I didn't play any part in that. But to go back to Cap Saint-Jacques, it was when we were down there that they made a collection of all the local Japanese weapons. And I remember them being laid out on the quayside and people being allowed to pick any single item that they wanted to take away. I believe General Gracie took a car. I took a dagger, which I brought home here and subsequently gave to a collector. It was quite a good one, I think, with a good trademark on it. I don't know what the local term is, but it was quite a valuable thing. The other entertainment we had there was from the French Navy, which always went off extremely well. They used to produce a couple of, I don't know what they were, light motorboats, LTBs, something like that, that pulled up alongside of a jetty that led offshore from quite near our camp. The only snag was that this jetty had one balustrade along the side of it. And the difficulty was when you were coming off the boat to remember which side of the balustrade the handrail was. But we had some quite good parties with that lot. And then they produced the Cardinal Richelieu came. I think, wasn't she the battleship that had been in the North African port when France surrendered? I think she was. And I remember going to have a meal in their wardroom and seeing a huge great mural of that episode painted on the wall there. But they were very polite and formal and pleasant for us. By this time, of course, cargo boats were pouring up the river to Saigon, restoring trade to as near normality as they could get. I suppose what rice was probably being exported. What else did they produce from there?
Rubber?
Almost for sure, yes. Anyway, they'd gone back to a fairly normal kind of existence and were bringing, of course, supplies in. The French came back in fair measure. I remember walking about in the marketplace in Saigon, seeing a lot of French people about.
What did the Indian troops think of being in Vietnam?
I don't think we asked them very much, quite honestly. They put up with it damned well. I think they were all longing to get back home. They were all delighted when news came that we were going to go home. We went back by sea to Lahore, which was where I left the battalion, and then went back to Waziristan, where the guides were serving.
Were you in India when independence came?
Yes, up in Waziristan, where, of course, independence hit us less probably than anywhere else, because we were carrying on with our normal traditional frontier operations. What did hit us, of course, was when we were ordered to post our Muslims, our Dogras, Hindus, and Sikhs down country. And I'll never forget, when I first joined the guides, I had taken over a company that consisted of two platoons of Pathans and two of Dogras, who are Hindu. And they got on extremely well together. And on this occasion, when they were parting company, I remember the Dogras being driven down through the lines of Pathans. Who were heartbroken at seeing these chaps go. And of course, a lot of them subsequently did get massacred on the journey down into India. Incidentally, that's another damn good reason for not trying to make a battalion all march in step. Because how you train a Dogra, who's a short little man, march in step with a tall Cuttack, who's a big, tall, lanky, long-striding chap, for efficiency, you just don't do it. You let them walk at their own pace as long as they keep up with each other. It was that kind of thinking we had in the guides that was, I think, damn good.
Would it have been impossible to have had the Dogras and the Muslim troops in the same platoon?
I wouldn't say it's impossible that it didn't happen. But, I mean, I've seen them on the same hill feature being shot up and going to each other's rescue alongside of each other. And in the field, there was no separating them.
Would it be advisable to have Muslims and Hindus in the same platoon?
I don't think it was efficient.
Why not?
Partly because of different eating habits. Different habits of culture.
Such as?
Well, let me give you an example. The other day I went down to Exmouth by train, and when I was buying my ticket, I couldn't understand what the ticket collector was saying to me. And when I got off the train at the bottom end, I went to the staff there and I said, "Where does that chap come from?" And they said, "Look, he's coming down the platform, ask him. He came from Glasgow." I think a similar situation arises probably amongst these different tribes people. The Hindus have natural taboos, you see, against certain kinds of, well, a lot of them to start with are vegetarian. We used to have to convert them and make them eat meat to a certain extent to build up their stamina. Whereas a Pathan wouldn't be, he would eat meat quite happily. A lot of their expressions and way of talking and that sort of thing differs quite a bit. Although, funnily enough, you see, again, certainly as far as we were concerned, we had four different religious leaders in the battalion, and they all got on very well. We chose them damn carefully, mind you. But they all got on extremely well together. There was no strife or disagreement or anything like that between them.
Did you have Sikhs?
We had Sikhs, yes, we did. Funnily enough, in one regiment I know of, it was traditional for Sikhs to do double guards, double duties. And they took a pride in it. And that was simply because they were so exuberant and bounding in energy that they had to be kept quiescent in a way that didn't apply to other troops. And they did this with a certain amount of pride. We used to take it out of them in playing hockey and things like that.
So, coming back to 47, yes. You didn't see anything of the communal disturbances?
No, thank God. Because from Waziristan, pretty soon, I was due home leave again. And I did not. I was asked if I would stay out and join the local forces. And I said no. If independence comes, they've got to be independent. And I don't want to be part of a delaying force. I was also asked, incidentally, if I would go and act as an instructor at the local university up in the Khyber Pass, where they were engaging a team to carry out studies in what are known as Nakaluna, N-A-Q, I don't think there's a U, L-U-N-A, I've got a copy of it here, which is local idioms that the Pathans use. They're quite, if you haven't come across them, they're quite amusing actually. They use them a great deal, and my father was very good at using them too. He had quite a reputation for that. You could very often turn a meeting into a cheerful, ribald grouping if you could produce the right Nakaluna at the appropriate moment. There was quite a skill in it.
But you decided not to stay on after independence. You decided not to stay.
That's right. I came home to England, where I was posted to the North Stafford Regiment. I went to the War Office and asked if I could rejoin the Devons, but they wouldn't have me. They'd got their quota of officers.
Now, going back to something you mentioned in passing during the interview, you said yes. There was an incident with the scouts that you wanted to recount.
That's right.
This goes back to the 1930s.
Yes. This was when I was with the scouts. I was made adjutant. So it must have been in my second year with the scouts. One night, I was woken up with a man coming, rushing to tell me that a post which we had reoccupied, it was an old scout's post, normally left vacant, but we had reoccupied it, called Boya, B-O-Y-A. And it was being beaten up by a man called the Fakir of Ippi, who made quite a reputation for himself in those parts. He actually had his own artillery, which he used to transport around the frontier on his own. And it makes me chuckle to think of it now. I remember telling the chap who gave me this information, I said, now you mustn't pass this news to anybody. keep your mouth shut. And don't go anywhere near the commanding officer. I knew that the local political agent was up in Rasmuk, which was quite a long way away. And I knew that we needed to shake hell out of these local people. So I got in touch with the Air Force, who occupied another part of our fort there at Miran Shah, and said, "Will you help me?" And they said, in their usual way, "Of course we will." They ran planes called Wapitis, which were single-engined biplanes with quite a low landing and take-off speed. And they said, "Well, look here, this is what we'll do. We'll get one of these aircraft going behind our gates, and you'll get a car across at the far end of the runway, and at the word go, we'll open the gate and take off and aim straight for that car, and then get up and go and bomb these local people." Well, unfortunately, the first plane ran into a ditch. But very gallantly, the RAF turned out a second plane, and they got that one airborne. And it took off, and it went up, and it didn't have to drop very many bombs. But the Fakir of Ipi and his troops were so shattered at being bombed by night, it was a thing that just wasn't done, that they faded away into the countryside very quickly, and the post was rescued the next day. But they'd been quite severely beaten up. Their wireless room had been shelled. They'd had a few casualties. But we got peace in the area. I don't know if the political agent was ever told what happened that night or not. I don't remember getting a rocket from my commanding officer because the operation had been successful. But I think as long as your operations were successful, you could get away with, I was going to say murder, but something very near it.
Could you tell me again about the wireless equipment that you had on the frontier?
Yes. I'm talking about the scouts and their wireless equipment. We had a small man-pack wireless set with which you could use speech, but if necessary, we operated on Morse. And our operators used to work to a pretty high standard. 9s to 15s used to be our speed, which was way ahead of the army. I don't know what the local civilian speed was, but it was quite fast. And as I say, the set was designed by a naval officer.
I think there's another story you want to tell me about Quetta.
I must tell you a story about life in cantonments in Quetta. A chap called Stover had bought himself a sporting gun. And I remember him going into the house. We four of us shared a bungalow. And he went with his gun into the bungalow and he said, "Rafe, just stand outside, will you, and let me know if it's working right." And he went inside and with his gun he blasted through the ceiling. And my job was to see if the pellets came out through the roof. Mind you, it was quite easy to repair a roof like that. You only wanted a few bits of matting and some mud.
Which year was this?
Must have been when I first went out to Quetta, 1934. Yes. And on another occasion, does it matter my mentioning all these chaps' names?
Don't think so.
Probably all dead now, poor devils. There are not many of us left. This child abuser used to drink rather heavily, and he woke up one morning in his bed, which was in the middle of the main road, under a mosquito net, with a table beside him and a jerry on top of the table, in broad daylight. And I think the first thing he knew was when he had his chota hazri, his early morning tea, brought to him. And then he had to get up and face... traffic was flowing, mind you, past him. Nobody taking wit or notice of him at all. But life was fairly ribald. It had its moments of fun.